Hi everyone, and thank you so much for joining today. Wherever you are in the world, it's really hot where I am, so I'm hoping you have better weather. Welcome to the fourth and which is the final webinar in our PBK Faith and Violence Against Women and Children webinar series. So as you will know, in October we did the first webinar, which was like a very basic introduction to PBK. And then in November, we had the second one, which focused on how we can identify and collect PBK. And then in January, we had a third one, where we were chatting about collating, analyzing, and documenting PBK. And now today, in our fourth and final one, we're looking at dissemination. And we are really privileged to have Selena Palm with us. She's chair of Working Group 2. But Selena and I have also worked together extensively for many years now, and we've done a lot of work around practice-based knowledge. So she's here with me today, and we're going to be chatting about this journey, and that's a metaphor you'll be hearing a lot about today. This journey of what do we do with PBK? How do we share it? So thank you so much, Selena, for being with us today. Let me just move our slides. So just a few quick housekeeping things. Please introduce yourself in the chat. You can mute yourself, but if your internet's good enough, it'd be lovely if you can keep your video on. We are recording this session, and the recording will be shared with all of the COP members, but it will also be on SVRI's YouTube channel and on the website, so it will be public. And please use the chat box to post comments or questions or thoughts. We will also be posting questions there a bit. Okay, so what is today about? I think to put it simply, what we find, and I've been part of this as well, many organizations, we collect powerful learning from what the organization has been doing around violence, around religion and violence, around working with faith leaders. But what often happens is that learning that is captured, it stays in internal reports, or it stays on your computer or in the conversations that we have. So today we want to talk about how do we help, how do we ensure that PBK actually travels, that it doesn't only stay in our organizations. It is important for our organizations, but how does it travel out? How does it travel further? And we're going to be framing this discussion around three key questions. And let me get the first one up. The first question that we're going to be discussing, and Selena's going to be leading on, is who is your practice-based knowledge for? Who's your PBK for? So, and what we're emphasizing here is that we need to start with the people, not with the products. So Selena, you and I have been chatting about this before, and if we're saying people are important, not the product that we're creating, what does that mean for you? And how do we get a handle on who the people that it should be for, who they are?
Thanks, Lisa. Hi, everyone. So what I find is that we often have a default audience, and that depends where we're situated. If we're a researcher in a university, we might be thinking about the university itself or the requirements for our research. If we're a consultant, we might be thinking who's funded it. So there's almost a default audience. And what I want to suggest is that can make other audiences in other types of people that the research or PBK is important for invisible. We may, when we start collecting PBK, have a particular idea in mind. We have particular people that we want to change. Most of us were working in the space around social change, particularly faith leaders and violence. So we have something in mind or someone in mind that we want to take on our journey with us. But along the way, as we collect the PBK and we analyze it and we write the report for the donor, sometimes we can forget, or we fail to even really grapple with who is that actual audience? And we get caught up in maybe our default audiences. So I want us to think about a couple of other types of audiences that there might be. Obviously, the one really important one is the community that is involved in the research. So if I'm doing violence against children, that might be child sector professionals. But it might interestingly also be children themselves, an audience that's often invisibilized. If we're doing work around the experience of survivors, survivors may also be our audience. And how will they see themselves represented in the outputs that we do? We often think of practitioners as being the audience for PBK, and we'll talk about this a bit more later. But I mean, the idea of PBK is that it sort of disrupts the evidence hierarchy, where we create, where researchers collect evidence and then it filters down to practitioners. We reverse that a bit. Practitioners become the site for knowledge creation, and practitioners in its broadest form. And therefore, we want to think creatively. Yes, the audience might be other practitioners, but it also might be speaking back. It might be to donors or policymakers in a different kind of way. And then again, when we think about policymakers, we may think, oh, but we want the government of our country to read, to get our PBK. We have to be realistic about our audiences. But we might say, well, we think of governments as policymakers, but there may be policymakers within our institutions, especially within our faith institutions, that are very influential. So it's important when we think about our audiences that we also think, well, which levels? It may not be realistic for us to say, well, we want the president to read our PBK, but we might say, well, we want the head of policymaking in our church, to actually read the recommendations that we're making. And I think an important thing to say here, is that there's not only one audience, there may be multiple audiences. And I want to encourage, and we'll think about this more when we think about outputs, not to just think, I want my PBK to reach everybody. It's going to be important when we think about our outputs to have thought about our different audiences and the different needs of those audiences. And we write in a certain way for academia. We might write in a different way for children. We might write in a different way for those survivors who have been deeply affected by the things that we're discussing. So multiple audiences and thinking about them in targeted ways and thinking beyond our default audience to those invisibilized audiences as well. And to not forget that when we think about PBK, we want to be disruptive. We don't just want to think, oh, we collect PBK so that practitioners can learn. We're collecting PBK so that practitioners are able to reach out to other audiences who may be used to being the one who ones who hold the power and the ones who teach others. And this may mean disruption within the classroom, that the teacher becomes the student and the student becomes the teachers. So I think I'll stop there. Back to you, Lisa.
Yeah, I mean, listening to you, Selena, I'm feeling very not judged, but I feel like, oh my word, how often have I been part of a process where, oh no, we're just collecting and writing this up because we need to convince the funder that good stuff came from the money. And that we never really went further to think about and reach so many of these other audiences that you've flagged, that can really benefit from this, and who we should be in conversation with our learning. I think, instinctively, if you think PBK, there's that funder voice, and then other practitioners, like you said, but it's not just that. I am wondering. I'm going to ask you a bit more about this, what you said about our invisible audiences, and specifically because I know you do so much work around violence against children. Is there, do you think, a responsibility? Do we have to reach all of these invisible audiences? Like, where do you think, just, I'm not meaning to put you on the spot, just
No,
give
that's
me your
fine.
thoughts on that, please.
So I think it's important that we don't think we have to reach everyone. That can feel super overwhelming. And both Lisa and I thought, oh no, there's so many audiences. And I think it's important, sorry, to think also about direct and indirect audiences. And this is maybe going to come up later as well. I'm going to use the metaphor of sort of, how is our PBK going to travel? And we're going to use that over our all three questions. And what I'm saying at this stage is we need to think about the destination, like where do, where do we want our audience to get? Who are our audiences, and where do we want them to get to? Realizing that our PBK may not get them all the way to the end destination we want, ending violence against children, but we may want to get them a certain bit along that way. And to spend a bit of time thinking about that. And there may well be a direct audience that we think this is feasible for us to reach. But there may al it also involves paying attention to indirect audience. I may say I want my research to reach Sunday school leaders, for example. I have Sunday school leaders on my course, and I want them to be reached directly with some of my material. But I'm also aware that they then have direct relationships with children. So in what we communicate and how we communicate it, we want to bear in mind that the people we're working with are working with children. So if we're providing all of our formats in ways that are very complicated, and very hard concepts to translate to children, it's going to be limited about how they can pass it on. So I want us to think, and one of the things I'm going to say, I've said already with audiences, we don't want our audience to be like a cinema audience. We come and we sit there with our popcorn and we watch the movie and we're passive. We're passive consumers. We pay our money and then we sit in the film and then we go home. We want our audience to be collaborators, and I'm going to talk later about ways to do that, but we want them to feel like they have skin in the game. They're involved in driving the vehicle to kind of get us to our different places. And I think this is important, that people can feel like the way in which you're giving them things means they can take it and they can continue the process of translating it, and moving it. So I think it's important we don't go, oh, this is my journey and I have to do all the steps. We think, how do we get people on our journey with us in a way that will have a ripple out effect? And we're going to move on to talk about outputs, but I think before we get to outputs, we need to think, who are our direct audiences, who are indirect audiences, to not think, oh my goodness, I must reach everybody, but I must think very specifically, maybe there's a couple of audiences that it's realistic for me to reach, and to think about whether these audiences are internal, and we're going to talk about this later, like internal to our own organization, where we know there's politics, and Lisa and I will share with you some PBK that we gathered within our own institution and the pushback that we got, or external. And these all relate to what our audience is and what kind of output we want to create. But I would say this isn't about beating ourselves up and going, oh my goodness, I didn't reach every single audience. It's about, often when I write a proposal, I'm really excited. I know what I want to do with the PBK I'm collecting. And somehow along the way, as I collect it all and I analyze it all and I write it up for the donor, I can get so exhausted that I kind of lose sight of the other audiences. And what I'm saying is, I think it's important, that we know for ourselves who our key audiences are, and that we're prepared to discuss that with our funders. Our funders always think that they're the key audience, and actually they're not. Sometimes they are, but there are other audiences as well. And I think when we bear them in mind first, that starts to shape how we disseminate our PBK in outputs, which I think is a question we're going to move on to a little bit later.
Thank you for that, Selena. I'm following the chat box here on the side, and Palikena flagged because I posted, what audiences do you tend to write or create for? And if we think about PBK, who do we want to reach? And please, everyone, do use the chat box. Palikena responded by saying, I usually think of the policymakers, program designers, or implementers, donors. This informs evidence-based practices. But now, this is kind of now leading to a question to you, Selena. However, I'm also thinking of the victims of GBV or faith-based leaders, etc. How can they understand or reflect on the experience or trauma or transform their practices in different institutions they influence? And I am wondering, survivors specifically, is that one of those indirect audiences, Selena? What are your thoughts on that?
So I think what I'm saying is, it's not one, it's not it's not for me to decide for everybody who is your indirect audience and who is your direct audience. And this is partly to do with your own positioning. So we have Susie on the call who, works directly with survivors, and therefore where we are positioned. I'm a faith leader. So where we are positioned has an impact on what our direct audience, what we choose as our
Can
direct
be.
audience, and that is going to be different. But what I'm saying, so Palakina there, thank you so much for giving all those examples. Sometimes we try and create something that's going to speak equally to all of those audiences all at once, right? We think, I want policymakers and victims, survivors and faith leaders all to readers. And sometimes that can work. But I think what we'll see when we move on to outputs is if we think carefully about who our audiences are, we can also think about the tailored way in which they will respond differently to different kinds of outputs. And we might, for example, say that actually, if we target faith leaders directly, faith leaders then have the ability to impact policymakers. That might be policymakers within their institution. So I work in a local branch of the Presbyterian Church, but my minister has access to the kind of Southern Council where all of the ministers from all across Southern Africa sit. He has access to that. So sometimes it can say, no, the policymakers might be the indirect ones, that we target people who have relationships with policymakers. Or we might be someone who sits in policymaking spaces, in which case we say, well, we might be targeting those directly. So there's not a right answer about who's our direct and who's our indirect, but it's important that we've reflected on that question and we reflect about where our skills may lie. Because the content that we collect, for example, if we're wanting to reach survivors, it is likely that they will want to see survivors themselves represented in our outputs and represented in a certain way with agency, with dignity. I mean, this should always be the case, but it may mean that our outputs need to be tailored to that audience. But if we haven't thought about the audience, we're less likely to create outputs that actually reflect the audience that we're trying to reach. Faith leaders love hearing from other faith leaders. Now, sometimes we need to challenge who they want to hear from, but actually, our outputs are more likely to be read. Our PBK is more likely to translate into action if, and we're going to talk about this later, if they're hearing from the people that that sort of they respect and want to hear from, and that will be different for different things. And I see Uwezu, you're also suggesting there in the chat the objectives of the intervention help define who the audience is. Yes, we're not deciding who the audience is in a vacuum, and that's why Lisa and I can think, well, sometimes the funder just tells us who the audience is. But yes, but sometimes the objectives of the intervention help us. But I'm saying this process, so we don't just jump straight in with let's collect all our PBK and then think about the rest later. That before we start our collection, we're actually thinking about our audience, which means that when we come to this stage, this sort of third stage, I think, in your process, we're going back to now remember who your audience was, as opposed to thinking, oh, hang on a sec, now I've got everything and analysed everything. Now who is my audience? And that is challenging. It's actually quite challenging to do that. It's very challenging for me to think, is any of the material I'm sharing accessible to children at all? Like, is it translatable and what does that look like? And how do you do that in a way that's safe and appropriate? It's not necessarily appropriate to interview children, but sometimes that is something that's done and those reports resonate for children in a different way.
Thank you so much, Selena. We're going to now. Yeah, I moved on to the next question. So, like I said, we have these three guiding questions for this dissemination journey. And the second one is around what form will make sense to them. So, if we first chatted about who is this for? Who's the audience? We have that answer or those answers to then think about what form. So, we're now actually tangibly thinking about the output. So, we so often do, oh, a research report or a policy brief, but is that the format that makes the most sense, that communicates the best? And here I think the language of translation is a very useful way of thinking about it. It's not different PBK, but it's how you package it. The language that you use, but also the format that you use is very important for us to think about. Selena, back to you, your thoughts on this.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to give a few examples. I'll give one or two, but before we kind of get into examples, I think somebody famous said, once the medium is the message. And this is why formats and being able to be creative about formats is important. Again, we often have a default format. There needs to be a 40-page research report, or there needs to be a journal article. And it's not saying that, again, that some formats are wrong and some formats are right. It's kind of saying tailor your output to your audience, but also to your timeline. And I can see it's in some of the things you've got in mind. And I'm going to give an example in a moment from my work with the University of the Western Cape, where the timing really influenced what outputs we did when. And again, it's not just one output. There might be multiple outputs And I think just encouraging you all to kind of be creative. We do fall into standardized long reports really easy in our sector and to academic language. And I think if we think about our audiences more and the invisible audiences, it can help us to then think about what kind of format does work. And that all these formats don't have to be written. I've had a lot of success with like short co-created videos where people share their oral testimonies directly, and this lands completely differently to if I'd written that up and written the story down somewhere and people had to read it before the class. So all I'm saying is when we think in a multi-sensory way, this can also help the information to kind of land in a different way. So I'm going to maybe give an example, and sorry, just with my little metaphor, so with the translation and the journey. Thinking about the journey and where we want to get people to, we can think about this stage as well. How are we going to get there? Are we going to go by car? Are we going to go by bus? Are we going to walk? Are we going to go by plane? And all of these have costs associated. It might be much quicker to go by plane, and much slower to walk, but one might be cheaper than the other. And we don't have to just offer one route. We may offer multiple outputs. There may be different kinds of ways. I often think of when I'm invited to a conference, they say, well, if you're coming from here, then you could do this. And if you're coming from here, then you could do this. And one of the other things that I think about is sometimes when I use communal transport and I travel on a bus, I get into all sorts of conversations with people on the way there. It's slower, but we travel together. And as opposed to me getting in my car and driving on my own. And in some of my outputs, like the course that I run for SVRI, I'm almost trying to create that mode of a bus. Like we're all in the same room and we start chatting about our lives and our stories and what's going on. And therefore, we get into conversations along the way. And sometimes we all know that those conversations along the way become more important than the formal things that we experience at a conference. So that's my little metaphor, and I'm going to stop there because I'm going down the rabbit hole in the metaphor. I want to give an example. So I did some work with the University of the Western Cape here in South Africa on gender equity and inclusion. I did a digital storytelling project featuring students' voices, a number of whom were survivors, and I also interviewed a large number of staff and some policymakers. And this was a 3-year project. And by the 3rd year, we were able to set up an interactive exhibition. The students had designed posters, the students who were the digital storytellers, but many of them were leaving at the end of that year. So we created a physical exhibition and we invited the students and staff who had been interviewed, who had been part of the process, to come and be part of that workshop. The students were able to present. We were able to play audio voice notes for people to listen to. People were able to kind of interact and talk about the findings of what they meant for their university. And that was able to happen almost immediately. The minute the posters were done, we were able to do this exhibition. We used the resources, we used a classroom, and we got it done really quickly. We also had a number of reports, and we had a book chapter that we were writing these sort of more typical outputs. The report only came out in 2025, 2 years after the end of the program. And that's because it takes a very long time to get a report produced in a way that an institution is going to accept. There was a really long time lag. Now, there were 3 reports and they came out 2023, 2024, 2025. But really, there was quite a significant time lag. And then we wrote, me and my colleague, a book chapter about higher education and gender-based violence. That's due out at the end of 2026. Now, those book chapters and reports will reach policymakers and academics around the world in a different kind of way. But if that had been our priority, none of the students and staff that we'd actually interacted with in this project would really have heard anything about this project. By the time they read anything in 2026, they'd probably all have completely forgotten about those interviews I did with them back in 2022. That interactive workshop that we did internally worked really, really well. And my colleague was then invited to present at a higher education conference for staff across universities. So we ran the same workshop there. Usually it was a 10-minute presentation, everybody giving 10-minute presentations, that kind of conference format. And we asked specifically for a 2-hour slot for an interactive workshop. And we were given that. And this was another way. If we'd sort of said that we wanted to publish our journal article, that would have taken a lot longer. But we went to the conference where people already were and we presented there. So I'm just using this example to show that you can have multiple different outputs, but they're different there's different time scales, there's different costs involved. And in some of those situations, we went to where the audience already was. We went to a student presentation, we went to a higher education conference. And I know in Lisa's Things to Keep in Mind, which I'm sure she's going to take us through a bit more now, those are some of the things to consider. And I feel very proud of those creative outputs. But time really was a factor there. It would have been quite easy to almost forget about feeding back if it hadn't been that the students themselves were leaving. And the students said, "Well, I want to be part of sharing this information which I've collected." I think I'm going to pause there so that Lisa can.
Okay. So I think, Selena, you already touched on a number of the bullets on the slide. But if you look at the first one, two, three, four, five, six of these bullets, it's super practical questions. You know, how quickly do you need to get it out? How much time do you have to create it? How much time do people have? Like, can they read a 40-page report or can they look at a flyer? What format shares most easily? So if you have an international audience, to have all these posters made is doesn't make sense. So I think, and I think Selena's metaphor of the travel is a good one for this. You've got to get practical with this. Like, what is doable within the parameters of who we are and who we want to talk to? But if we look at the fifth one, sixth one, what format can be shared with different audiences? Kind of maybe like a tip more, but I'm going to give you an example. And this is a project that Selena and I worked on together on campus rape culture. And we did this study, or we did this project with women students, and it was around their experiences and understanding of campus rape culture. And it was, we used photo voice, so they took pictures and they recorded voice notes. And it was the same thing as Selena experienced at UWC, because that was also during COVID. We had to move quickly because they were leaving university and, getting their degrees. So we ended up prioritizing and creating a website. And I'll put the link in for you if you want to take a look at it. That was all just about sharing with each of the six women students, their journeys, their understanding, and their experiences. And that was our first primary output. But it ended up being an amazingly useful output format in terms of dissemination in so many spaces. So whether we were at academic conferences or community conversations or engaging with students in later years at the university, we could constantly refer back to the website, because people were very interested. And you could say, okay, like, I'm explaining this thing, but here's the link. Go and look at it. So, you do have these formats that have the ability to really speak at in very different spaces and communicate well and disseminate well in very different spaces. I think, and this connects to the next bullet around outputs that directly represent and communicates in a different way. What we've experienced, and Selena, you can also add on to this if you want to, is with that project, this was also the case at UWC, we had photos, but we also had voice note recordings from students. And having these women share their experiences in their own words, in their own voices, at academic conferences, at engagement with policymakers, education conferences, we could actually play those voice notes and have them speak themselves. It made an incredibly, it just communicated so differently to
In there,
you.
because you know me, I like chipping in, and I want to tie what Lisa's saying about the voice notes to the point that Susie's made about the last point here: who and what do people trust? And we're going to speak a little bit more on the third question around using trusted intermediaries. But in a lot of our work, the direct voices of students, many of whom were survivors, but a diverse range of students, was incredibly powerful. And it was powerful at not only reaching to the sort of intellectual, to the head. And often policymakers know, sort of say, well, no, just give me the statistics, just give me the Excel spreadsheet. It was incredibly powerful at changing the feelings in the room. Like I had people in my session crying when they listened to voice notes directly from the student. And in my course as well, we find a similar thing, that there's something that people talk about when they hear directly from the person concerned, in a way that's unmediated, as opposed to me writing it up and doing a one-line quote from somebody, that can have a powerful effect. It's not always the right approach, but there's a trust there of, like, I'm hearing it straight from the horse's mouth. I'm hearing straight from the person. And this was really powerful in our institution, of staff hearing from students and hearing what students were saying about their experience. They found it much harder to deny it when it was coming from the students that they knew than if it was something we were saying as external people kind of coming in. So this question, and this is true with faith leaders as well, who do people trust? Who is saying that, who is saying thing, and to really think about that when you're thinking about how you're sharing your PBK. So it's important that you also think about this. There are benefits and there are risks to going internally and going externally. Sometimes you can have incredibly important conversations with people in private that won't make sense if you have them in public. So there are values of the privatized space, but there are also value to the public space where you're able to put pressure on policymakers from the outside, because this conversation goes broader than them. So again, these things are simple questions for you to think about. It's not that we give you answers, but we say, as you are thinking about sharing your PBK, these are very practical steps to actually go through. And if you go through these, you may come up with a very different response to what outputs you actually want to maybe your default. And Susie, I agree with you. The who or what do people trust, in an era of fake news in particular, and overwhelm in terms of information, I would say this piece is incredibly important. And this affects not only the output you choose, but who you have representing, and whose voices you are quoting from. And I found with PBK, trying to create a sense of directness, like Lisa said, we did with the students, really helps people to feel like they're engaging directly with the texture of the research, whether that's stories of survivors or quotes, or direct voices, and enabling people to hear from those straight from the horse's mouth. I'm going to stop there. Lisa.
Yeah, sorry, I was just unmuting myself. I really want to invite everyone in the room, use the chat. We're actually super curious, what formats have you used? Has it only been research reports or policy briefs, or have you used other ways, maybe more creative or artistic ways, to disseminate your PBK? I'm very curious. We'll give you a moment to share around that, and we're going to move on to our third question. So the third question is around, how do we help PBK move? So and this is, as you'll see on the slide, this is the real dissemination conversation. So, and full disclosure, I've been that person that creates a PBK, go through the whole process of surfacing PBK, analyzing it, collating it, creating what I think is an amazing output. And then I swear seven people maybe access it or read it. So the PBK doesn't really move. There isn't the communication, there isn't the travel that we hoped for or that we expected. So we're going to chat a bit more about how do we get our PBK actually to reach others, our output, our format that we use. I'm going to put the next slide up. I don't, anyway. Selena, and I'm handing over to you.
Okay. Sorry, I'm like, where are my notes? So I'm just give me a like my note, I think I clicked something out, so my notes just disappeared, but that's okay. I'll all right, let me let just bear with
I can get us
a
started if you first want to find it, Selena.
moment. So it's all right, I'll say one or two things and then I'll come back. Ugh, losing all my words. So sorry, like Lisa's saying, this sort of actually, the actual process of moving. So we can have decided our car or our plane or whatever, but if there's no fuel in the tank, we're not going anywhere, right? And what is it that fuels? Is it our legs? Is it drivers? Is it petrol? And one of the things that I've noticed in the work that I've done is kind of one of those things I said at the beginning, it's not all on you. It's like about mobilizing your audience, not just to be your passive audience, but to get involved in helping you share, of being part of the energy. So, rather than just having, one person driving the car, like ask everyone to take a shift, So involving people. And I found that involving people, giving everybody different roles to play, builds a way in which PBK then spreads through relationships. So that piece that Susie was saying about the trust, this is also true in terms of sharing information. How do we share information in a way that's trusted but spreads through pre-existing relationships? I think this is particularly true in kind of faith settings. So certainly in terms of my PBK, I'm doing work around child safety and child safeguarding in faith institutions at the moment. And I've ended up going to like a church, like a Presbyterian church meeting, which is not something that I would normally do, but I'm going to the space where there's a whole bunch of ministers already there, and there's an agenda, and I can put it as an item on the agenda, and I can get the floor. So presenting at existing gatherings, using trusted intermediaries, working with, our minister getting me an in to be able to kind of go into that space. And we also know that repeating messages over time. So I think, Lisa, one of the things you were saying was, dissemination is a process, not an event. So the problem we have sometimes, I think, is those collecting all the information is we want to give it to people all at once. We want them to see the whole thing all at once, and we can overwhelm people. And there's sometimes a need to have drip feed. So thinking about a process over 6 months of starting conversations, starting dialogues, drip feeding things in. This can be particularly helpful in faith leader settings, in, for example, weekly meetings or weekly sermons, where over time we're drip feeding little bits of information in to your audience in ways that they're actually able to take on board. The risk, I think, of writing too much or giving too much all at once, or trying to reach everybody again all at once, can feel overwhelming. So, Lisa, I think we're going to move on to talk about your key tips in a moment, but I'm going to hand back over to you whilst I find my notes. Says.
So you'll see there are five tips up on the screen, and I mean, Selena already touched on some of them, but I think what's really important is to realize, and I'm a researcher, that is a big part of what I am, and very often your thinking goes to, oh, I created the output. That's the end point. That's the goal that we're working towards. And I think what's very important with PBK is to realize that the process isn't to get to producing an output. That's like a halfway point. The process is to have the output so you can have the conversations afterwards and the engagement afterwards. PBK, I think, fundamentally isn't like a typical research project of just, collecting data and then presenting it. But it's yes, it's collecting something, but it's what it allows you to discuss and what it allows you to engage on and unpack is it can be quite profound. So I think really to from the start, realize this is longer than just that point of creating the output. At the same time, the first bullet says it start with one audience, not everyone, because it can feel super, super overwhelming. It's like, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? I think it's the same thing. And And also, what I've really, and I've experienced this, is the start of the process, you don't know what doors will open. You know, I think especially within faith institutions that are so relational, it's that one person that hears about this maybe at a sermon and comes and chats with you afterwards that connects you to this person there, that it really is that way. And to trust that process, that, you know, this will get to where it needs to go, and we will have the conversations that are needed. I think it is, at the same time, you know, it's kind of a balance of just, you know, going with the flow and where the energy is, but also being intentional and thinking, where can I reach the audience that we think we need to reach? And that's go to where people meet. So if it is policymakers, is there some kind of conference where they all gather? Do I need to go see people in their offices? Whatever it may be. But you will also, you know, think intentionally about where are the spaces. And then, you know, Susie, you raised this, and Selena, you discussed this with our previous question, but this thing about trusted messengers cannot be overestimated. Like, it really, people listen differently if it comes from someone that they trust versus you maybe as an outsider, or as a researcher, or as someone from a different faith or from another group. Maybe let me pause there, hand back to you, Selena, if you want to add to any of those first 3 points.
Thanks. Actually, I want to speak about the fifth one, but before I get on to the fifth one, I think this idea of ripple audiences is really important. Like, you're building allies. So that point I made at the beginning about not passive audiences. If you start with one audience, it's good to start with the audience you think in a way is going to get on board. So I started with the students who had been part of the research, or I started with my course alumni, because as they get on board, doors open, and that ripple out effect where your first tier audience then enter start conversations with other people and it starts to ripple out is a really important part of taking the pressure off you to be the one that does all the dissemination. So being strategic about this is really, really sensible. And this ties into kind of point four: repeat, adapt, reshare. One of the things I found quite helpful is giving like bite-sized chunks to people for them to use in different settings, that you don't say, well, this is the thing and everybody must use it in this particular way. Like, if you involve people and allow them, give them permission, and you have to be careful about this, but you give them permission to adapt your outputs, or your outputs are adaptable in a way. Like, I have a whole bunch of different video clips, which I use in a certain way, but I also say to people, if you want to borrow one of those video clips to use it in your own way, in your own church, just let me know and I'll send it to you. And there's an act of trust going on there of how are they going to use it. But it's also saying that may be much more effective than trying to get everybody to come onto your course, in the example that I'm using. So this kind of allowing for adaption, and it also gives permission. So when you run something as a pilot, and this ties into the don't wait for perfect products, when you sort of get going with something and you admit that it's not perfect, you allow also for people to contribute into it with ideas. You enable them again to become an active audience. So some of my most successful dialogues have been this interactive, where we say, well, here's something to start discussion, but I want to have a conversation around it. We don't try and have the perfect answer. We don't try and write the 67th book of the Bible, the canon of how it has to be. We offer something, but we create a space for conversation. And there's a danger sometimes with outputs that we kind of think they have to become the answer. We think they must just, they must be the conclusion. And I think there's value in these imperfect products that create conversation. I'm doing a series of co-authored dialogue briefs at the moment. And in these dialogue briefs, I'm deliberately trying to feature different voices so that different people who read them can identify with those different voices. And it's moving away from the idea there's only one thing that we can say about nonviolent parenting, which is the topic. And it's allowing people to kind of find their way in. Well, what are the kind of conversations we need to have with different people? And they're conversations, and we're going to say different things. And when we do this, we create a space which invites others to join us in the conversation. And we know that this is important for learning. When we create outputs that seem like they're perfect, we create an illusion that we kind of have all the answers. And this isn't always the best thing. So I want to encourage us, and it also ties us up in knots, those of us writing masters or PhDs or journal articles, we can get really tangled up in that it needs to be perfect. And I think if we're more able to sort of see things as provisional, see them as conversation starters, enable us to enter into dialogue with other people, and that our outputs are designed for that, we also go beyond, like Lisa was saying, we go beyond the output being the final product, the final solution, and we say this is something along the way. This is the thing that simulates the conversation, and actually it might be in the conversation that the real magic takes place.
Thank you so much, Selena. I want to bring in Yasuzi, if you don't mind, if I put you on the spot. If you can share what you shared about your church academic journal and that way of engaging, because I think, that's such a lovely way of just reaching, because people, well, can you share a bit, please, Susie?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Thank you, Lisa. And thank you, Selena, both of you for this. I'm learning so much. So we have an academic journal. It's not by the church itself. It's independent and it's funded by independent people, but it's the only journal for our church to put out information, but it's not tied to the church so that they don't oversee the scholarship, et cetera. I just want to make that clear because that's important. They're not funding it. It's not, that affects the scholarship. So it's independent. But what they do is if they only accept a few journal articles every year, so it's hard to get in. But if you do get an article in, they publish your journal with a piece of artwork that's been done by someone in the church, an artist. But they also, so they have that in written form, and that goes out through a high press that's totally reputable. And it's t the peer review process is like crazy hard, which is good because that gives it clout, right? Which we want. But then they do a voice recording. So that anyone who doesn't have the time to read it, they can listen to it in the car or whatever. And so you can just listen to it, which is an amazing feature they've added. Then on top of that, they are going to bring you into a webinar and you are going to have a conversation with one of the editors of the journal. And these are really highly skilled, articulate people that I can't keep up with, but they sit and ask you questions about why did you write this? What inspired this? And let's talk about some of the key points. And this goes for about 45 minutes and that goes on YouTube. So people always have access to that also so that they can see you. They introduce you as an author, like nobody knew who I was. I mean, who am I? Susie Greco, this 50-year-old woman writing about gender violence, But then she's like, oh, you're a survivor, and you're a member of the church. And so you get introduced as a real live person having written this article and what brought you to this place and the outputs. And that is highly effective. So in the research I do, I'm a PhD student. People, all the survivors that I'm interviewing, they go look me up. They listen to me. They want to know who I am. And this impacts who, whether they're going to trust me. And that goes back to the trust, building the trust. No one wants to speak out in our church. It's because people get excommunicated. So this level of trust is really important. And these people are like, okay, I think I can talk to you. I think I can share with you. I think you're a safe person. So, anyway, that's probably more than you wanted, but yeah.
I think, Susie, I mean, so many things that you just said really resonated. But the one that I want to respond to is, I think practice-based knowledge already connects differently for what it tries to capture and reflect on, and formats that allows for that humanity and connection, like a conversation, I think is just so well suited to PBK. And what you said about the artwork that accompanies it, more, in the last 5 or 10 years, I've been doing more and more arts-based methods in my research itself. And It really just connects differently. And I think that challenges all of us in terms of how we do think about our packaging around our dissemination. So thank you so much for bringing that in. Selena, anything you want to add?
I kind of, just as an end note, I suppose, and thanks, Susie. We talk about PBK being subversive, and I think it's important we see it as subversive all the way through. Not only in its content, but in its in its medium, in how it's disseminated. So we're talking back to an establishment that has very particular rules around evidence construction and around how things are allowed to be done and around formats. So I just want to encourage people to continue to think subversively, think about disseminating things differently. I think, like Lisa's saying, and Susie, that kind of story base, the orality as opposed to the written word, the connecting to the heart, the affect, not just the intellect. These are all ways in which PBK is able to add something different. And it's important, that we travel this through into the dissemination. We may collect amazing content, we may analyze it in really creative ways, but if we only then disseminate it using the standardized formats, a lot of that gets lost because it doesn't end up with the people that need to hear it. I'm not a fan of AI, but I'm going, like, one of the small things that I've noticed that academia does now, which I think is amazing for academics, is they'll take our 20-page journal articles that lots of people are never going to read, and they'll turn them into 5-minute podcasts. So in an article that I did, which I'm really proud of, but which I'm sure very few people have read because it's full of lots of very long theological words, A Time to Confess, they turned this into a 5-minute podcast. And I sent that around to the young people in my church. Lots of people are going to listen to a 5-minute podcast. And it elicits a curiosity in a completely different way. Like, I find the 5-minute podcast much more interesting than the 20-page article. So there, and that wasn't me. I didn't have the resources to kind of go off and do that. So just to encourage you to use these new modes of connecting, to use AI where it's helpful, and to use creative methods of visual and oral as ways to allow the subversives of PBK to speak back to your audiences, whoever your audiences are. And at the beginning, I spoke about that invisible audience of children in my work, and you will have invisible audiences that you will also think of. And the oral, the telling a story, the hearing about a person, that is something that children can connect to. And sometimes I think we're so caught up with, like, being fancy and using long words and, like, getting it signed up by the academic journal, that we forget that actually some inside all of us is a small child that is also wanting to be like, what's the story and how can I connect to it? So, Susie, thank you so much for sharing that. Susie is also a member, contributor on my course, and her oral story shared in a trust-based way has been fundamental. So I just think that these formats and being willing to play around with formats and to get it wrong. Like, sometimes we do something, we go, okay, that didn't work so well. And to have less fear about trying new things is really, really important. I just want to encourage all of you on the call, those of you who are becoming writers, thinking about research, to continue to stay connected to the audiences that you know that you want to reach, and be willing to push back on with your funders if they go, well, we're the audience. Well, maybe you are, but you're only one of them, and you're maybe possibly not the most important one either. Yeah, that's me.
That's a good note to end on. Thank you so much, Selena. Just on behalf of all of us, thank you so much for giving us your time and your wisdom and your examples. It's just been very inspirational. Palikena, you posted that you have a lot of data and you'd be interested to be mentored in writing on it. We have now started a small pilot. A practice lab around where we're supporting five people from five different organizations in writing up practice-based knowledge around faith and GBV. This is a pilot that we then hope to refine, and that this can be something that continues running within the COP. So watch this space. We hope that will be possible. But again, thank you for joining us today. Thank you for everyone who's been here with all the different webinars in the series. And it's just been lovely sharing this space with you. And Hope we see you again with whenever we next do something on PBK. Thank you, everyone. Bye bye.